Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is David Barrett. It is my privilege to represent Mr. Robison in these proceedings. The reason that we are here today is the importance of having a unified and solid process for the some 600,000, more than 600,000, Missouri citizens that hold professional licenses of one sort or another. Mr. Robison held a bail bond general agent license. He had held a bail bond license in one form or another for a number of years and was doing his ordinary work and did the ordinary renewal application when he received in the mail notice that his renewal application had been rejected. The renewal application rejection was done completely ex parte, with no input from him, with no inquiry of him. And the question then became, and the question you have to answer today is, what should he have done? In this case, I did not accidentally or mistakenly choose with Mr. Robison to seek a writ. The reason that we made that conscious decision was because the Director of Insurance has an extraordinary power to ignore the findings of the Administrative Hearing Commission. In a routine licensing matter, in the vast majority of licensing cases, when a license application is denied, the person has the right to appeal to the Administrative Hearing Commission, and the Administrative Hearing Commission steps into the shoes of the licensing body and then makes a de novo determination of whether or not the license should be granted, or in this case, granted a renewal. The director of the Department of Insurance does not have that over his head. The statutes specifically provide that the director retains discretion in refusing a license renewal, and their discretion does not transfer to the Administrative Hearing Commission. It is for that reason that we decided to proceed with a writ instead of the empty formality of proceeding for months before the Administrative Hearing Commission for a decision that ultimately would not be binding on the department. We would be glad to litigate this case before the Administrative Hearing Commission. And it would be very easy for the director to have filed a complaint saying, these are the things that you did wrong, and these are the reasons that I don't want to renew your license, or these are the reasons even that your license is subject to discipline, and I could censure you or suspend you or revoke your license extant because you did these things. But we never had that opportunity. And if
you had the opportunity, just didn't decide to pursue it because it wasn't binding.
Because
on the
it's pointless.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, what if the director looked at it and said, you know what, they're right. You know, I've read the administrative hearing ruling, and you know what, I decided this incorrectly.
And in that case, the Administrative Hearing Commission's decision is advisory, and the director in good faith can make a decision, do I want to do this or do I not want to do this? But that's the problem with these cases. I've been handling these cases, Judge, for 15 years now. The Director of Insurance is the agency that, once the Administrative Hearing Commission rules, does not have a disciplinary hearing, so to speak, or a subsequent hearing, so that the director can decide. That's it. Once the Administrative Hearing Commission rules for you or against you, the director takes no action. These decisions by the Administrative Hearing Commission truly are pointless because the director does not act upon them. The director is not required to act upon them.
So you're saying even if we were to require exhaustion for non-contested cases, we have some cases that say where any review is illusory, you don't have to go through it, where it's just advisory.
And that's exactly what I relied on when Mr. Robison and I met, and we talked about how should we pursue this case. Because we knew that out there was the decision that said, if it's illusory, you don't have to use it. And that's the law that we followed. Now, it may have just been a court of appeals case, but it's still binding upon us, and we still relied upon it in making the decision of how to proceed.
So how do you, what's your basis to argue or to establish that it's illusory? I mean, what's the, I mean, other than the fact that they've never followed it in the past, is there something else that you can hang your hat on to say, well, why wouldn't keep them from doing it in this case?
Well, it's 374.051. It's in the statute, Judge, that they don't have to follow it. The director retains discretion. You can do whatever you want, and I still retain discretion.
I can't think of the case, but we've had two cases I know you all talk about in the briefs where that you could file an appeal and there would be a hearing and advisory ruling made, but where I think it was the sheriff in one case and someone comparable in another then had full discretion in making the decision. We said you weren't required to go through that process because it was simply advisory.
And that's the problem. The problem here is Mr. Robeson had a business. He'd been in business since 2007. He had defendants out on bond. This isn't a question of, well, he was able to do his day-to-day work and things like that. He had a financial interest. He had a financial stake in making sure people showed up to court. He had promised the court that they would come. And then one day, he can't make them come anymore. Under penalty of criminal prosecution, he can't go out and arrest the people that don't show up to court. Because
well,
the director,
Ms. Neal points out that he had a really long time in which he could and he did not. And she also says she thinks that it's not illusory and that there could be a binding decision.
I'm sorry, Judge, I missed
I believe she also says that she believes it's not illusory and there could be a binding decision under the statute. She reads it a little bit differently than you do.
She does, and that's where the real advantages of oral argument. I've been doing these cases, Judge, for 15 years. There may be that possibility, but that's not the way it works. That's why Gurley was so important. I was doing these cases at the Attorney General's office, and then I was over at the Division of Professional Registration as their senior legal counsel, and we were completely confident. Judge Ardini was my division director. Judge Mitchell was the deputy director, deputy attorney general at the time, and we did not deny renewals because we wanted to give people their due process rights, protect the renewal process. If you wanted to discipline them, that was fine. But you don't do it by simply saying, no, we're not going to let you have your license anymore. And in this case, I was there when Doug Oman, I was one of his subordinates, when he was deputy director of insurance, and he was offended that his decision could be changed by the Administrative Hearing Commission, and that's why 374.051 was changed. It was changed uniquely. No other licensing agency has the ability, and that's not quite completely true, but no other licensing agency has the ability in a situation like this one to make the decision and then after the administrative process say, no, I'm not going to follow it.
And are you saying there's unfettered discretion or is there some, are there some strictures on the discretion of the director?
And that's the difficult question. If there is restriction on the director, it's not spelled out in the statute. It doesn't say that he should review it. It doesn't say that he has to, he certainly doesn't have to follow it. And that's the problem in this case, and that's why we chose the remedy that we did and have pursued that. The problem with it is this sudden decision without any opportunity to address the director or to address someone, in most cases the Administrative Hearing Commission, that has the power to correct the mistakes. In this case, what we get into here is the underlying facts of the case, judges, and I don't necessarily want to do that, Mr. Chief, but the fact of the matter is the director made errors in this case. Those errors are the result of the conflicts between the Bail Bondsman Act, our new statute, relatively new, and this court's Rule 37. Rule 37 says if you have an unsatisfied judgment, you can't post bond. It's simple. But bail bondsmen do that all the time.
But the statute incorporates our rule and says you have to comply with our rule. So where's the conflict?
The conflict is in 374, 7063, where if a final judgment ordering forfeiture is not paid within 6 months, the court can extend the judgment or report the judgment to the Department of Insurance so that it can take disciplinary action. This is an extraordinary statute because it attacks the finality of judgments. We know from a number of cases that once the judgment is entered, with the bond forfeiture judgment is entered, it is final. But we also know that in the workaday world of criminal defense, judges routinely set those aside. And in this case, the statute actually tells them, hey, after 6 months, if you think it's appropriate, you can extend the judgment. I don't even know what that means. I don't know of any other case where a judge can extend his judgment date simply to avoid the finality of judgment, and in the case of bail bondsmen, disciplinary proceedings. And that's what happened in this case, specifically in the director's order, paragraph 15. The Winkleman forfeiture was dated March 29th. The Brooks forfeiture was March 24th. And the license revocation was July 29th, 4 months later. They weren't even to the 6 months yet to where the statute seems to think discipline's appropriate. But those flaws aside, the real question, and I think that the reason that we're here today and where the Court of Appeals just absolutely threw me for a loop, was this idea of you have to exhaust remedies that make no difference. And that is what I would hope you would find, that since the remedy made no difference, there was no requirement for exhaustion, and mandamus should be considered by the circuit court in this case. My time being exhausted, I thank you.
May it please the court. Council seeks a unified, solid process for licensees to take up appeals. That's called the Administrative Hearing Commission, and it's been here since the 1970s. The problem in this case was that Mr. Robeson chose not to avail himself of it. Now he would say, well, the AHC hearing would be pointless. It would be mere window dressing. That's simply not the case here. It's not pointless here because, for example, Mr. Robeson in some of his pleadings said, well, we intend to refute some of this hearsay that was before the director, some of this evidence. And that can go to the AHC, and that's where those kinds of issues can be resolved.
Well, they can be, but this is a really unusual statute, and it says the director, notwithstanding the rule on the AHC, you can go to the AHC, the director shall retain discretion in refusing a license or renewal, and such discretion shall not transfer to the Administrative Hearing Commission. So what's the point? You might get relief, but in the prior cases where we've addressed with something similar and we've called it just window dressing,
right,
you could go to another committee or commission and they might make a recommendation which the person with firing authority might follow, but we've said they're certainly not obligated to, therefore there's no point in requiring you to go through that process when it's merely advisory.
Right.
Why is this not merely advisory? It might take the advice, but why isn't it merely advisory?
It is not merely advisory. Under these facts, for example, had Mr. Robeson gone to the Administrative Hearing Commission, the Administrative Hearing Commission might have said, you know what, these judgments aren't final.
Would the director have had to follow that, or would that have been merely advisory to the director?
The director would have had to follow that. If the Administrative Hearing Commission finds that the mandatory disqualification of Rule 3317 was not proper under the facts in that case, the director has to follow it.
Can you follow that, address that a little bit further?
Yes.
You're saying portions of it as to matters that are committed to the discretion of the director, it's merely advisory, but as to matters of law, it's not merely advisory?
Well, I would characterize it differently. I don't think it's advisory at all in the first place.
Well,
but
then,
tell me
what that language means that I just read.
Right. I do think that the Administrative Hearing Commission can take up those types of issues of law. Did the mandatory disqualification that the director is asserting, is that correct under the facts? Or, for a different example, under 374.755, there might be cause as opposed to a mandatory disqualification. And the AHC can take up those issues and witnesses are cross-examined and so forth to determine if the facts underlying the director's asserted cause actually meet the threshold and clear the threshold of cause.
And what if they find out it doesn't? What if they hold it does not?
That's the end. And the AHC can say, you know what, you do not have cause to refuse to issue or renew that license.
And they can direct reinstatement and it has to be reinstated because the
generally that's what the AHC does.
But is that legally required or is that simply advisory?
No, I think that's required. If the director has not shown cause under 374.755, then the director cannot take away the license. The director cannot refuse to issue the license. And here I must point out, I disagree with Mr. Barrett's assertion that nothing else goes back to the director. That's not true. In a case of, for example, cause under 374.755, if the AHC were to find that the director indeed had cause, that threshold was crossed, then it goes back to the director in a disciplinary case. So I reject that that never goes back to the director. That's not true. I also have to reject the assertion of counsel that this rejection of the renewal somehow came as a tremendous surprise to Mr. Robeson. The facts before the trial court were that he had unsatisfied bond forfeiture judgments, several of them. And under Rule 3317, that is an absolute disqualifier. As part of the statutes under Chapter 374, bail bondsmen have to submit a form that says whether or not they have unsatisfied judgments. And Mr. Robeson did so in the spring of 2016, and he said initially, I do not have any such judgments. But then as the spring wore on, April, May, and June, into the summer of 2016, he listed several bail bond forfeiture judgments beginning in April of 2016. So to assert that in July 2016, when the director refused to renew the license, that this came as somehow a shock or surprise, I don't think can possibly be correct. Because again, as required by law, he is self-reporting these forfeiture judgments.
Is he right? There's a conflict between the language, even though the statute incorporates the rule and says you should follow, that the rule says just what you said, but the statute appears to give him the judge discretion to extend the time for 6 months.
I think the critical distinction there is the difference between a judgment that is final and then execution on that judgment. This court's rules are clear that a judgment, generally speaking, is final after 30 days. At that point, it is final. At that point, from the standpoint of bail bond forfeiture judgments, whether or not the defendant is finally brought back into court is really irrelevant. That judgment is due and payable. Of course, from a criminal standpoint, we want defendants to appear in court, but that judgment is final. The statute gives the court the opportunity to give the bail bondsman 6 months grace, essentially, but it's not required, and the court does not have to do that. And whether or not it does that does not in any way affect the finality of that judgment or the fact that that bond forfeiture judgment is due and payable. And that brings up, for me, another point in terms of counsel said, well, the director could have filed for discipline in this case. And that's true. But the director can also refuse to renew when there are these outstanding bond forfeiture judgments.
So it's not automatic that you don't renew when there's bond forfeiture judgments? If that's our rule, isn't it?
Yes. If there's bond forfeiture judgments, yes.
So what discretion is there then?
Well, in terms of the director can wait for somebody to pay those judgments. A trial court might give the 6 months grace, and the bail bond agent might come in and pay those, for example, within a month and take care of those judgments. So the fact that the director did not immediately swoop in and file a discipline case in April of 2016, when Mr. Robeson first reported bond forfeiture judgments against him, that works in Mr. Robeson's favor. It gives him time to take care of that. Again, perhaps the court had given him 6 months to do so. Perhaps not. But again, the director doesn't swoop in with a discipline case when there are one, two, or even three bond judgments, as occurred here in the spring of 2016. The director can give the bail bond agent time to cure. And that didn't happen here. So when the renewal rolls around in July and August of 2016, query how the director could possibly have renewed that license when judge, as you just stated, under 3317, it's an absolute non-starter. If he has bail bond forfeiture judgments, he is not qualified.
C- Can you address the issue of whether there you have a property interest in a renewal? Does the statute provide any different procedure for renewals than for first issuance of a license?
I don't think the statutes provide a difference in procedure. I do think it would be anomalous to suggest that applicants had to clear a different bar than renewal applicants. But I will say, and as I pointed out in the brief, I don't know that Missouri law is entirely clear that a renewal applicant has a property interest in the renewal of the license, in contrast to someone who has an existing license. And the case law talks about, is there some degree of discretion? And I think that's true here in terms of whether or not you renew the license versus, for example, a case where a statute might say the license shall be renewed if you pay your money and if you offer a current inspection. Contrast that with the scenario here in terms of the director in bail bond situations generally would have to look at cause or whether there's a mandatory disqualification. Indeed, and it's a bit interesting, in this case, Mr. Robeson has said the director has no discretion not to renew him. But in fact, under Rule 3317, I'm not sure the director has any discretion, any power to do anything but refuse to renew because he is manifestly not qualified. And on that score, it is important to note that those facts have never been in dispute. The facts before the trial court were there are bond forfeiture judgments against Mr. Robeson. Those were agreed to. Nobody was disputing those. He was manifestly unqualified under Rule 3317. So again, query what the director might have done otherwise. Otherwise, she could be, who knows, facing a lawsuit on that score. I do want to point out also, in terms of the remedy here, mandamus, for the reasons I've just articulated, is completely inappropriate. The director really had no choice but to refuse to renew because there are disqualifying bond forfeiture judgments. If there are no additional questions, I thank the court.
Mr. Chief. The problem that we have is, quite frankly, one that the court is already dealing with. What do we do with the bail bond system? What do we do with people that are arrested? How do we let them go? Aside from releasing everyone under recognizance, which we know sometimes is an inadequate assurance of their appearance. The court is struggling with that. Certainly we have struggled with that since Ferguson. I was fortunate enough to spend some time as a municipal judge, so I became very familiar with this court's direction on what we were to do with bonds and when bonds were to be required and those sorts of things. So I assume the court is still struggling with those issues because we certainly have not seen a complete restatement of what the rules are going to be. And this is one of them. There is, I can tell the court, not a bondsman of any significant size in this state that does not have a forfeiture pending virtually continuously. We know that those are out there, and for some reason, the director focused on Mr. Robeson and decided not to renew his license, and decided not to renew it within the 6 months, with the idea that perhaps Mr. Robeson might choose to appeal to the Administrative Hearing Commission, where he files his complaint within 30 days of the denial, and then the director has 30 days to answer, and now we're at the 6 months. And the judgment is not only final in the legal sense, but final under the statute that controls bail bondsmen. So there isn't much of a problem for the director to simply say, yes, go and take this thing, go and take this appeal that doesn't actually bind me and let time pass. And oh, in the meantime, you can't use self-help because if you do, you're violating the law. Because I have not renewed your license, you can't go out and arrest the person. You cannot recover the fugitive. It's illegal to do so. You'll go to jail if you do. Instead, what I suggest to the court is that we use the practical way that circuit and associate circuit judges every day in this state do. They look at these things practically. Where is the guy? He's not here. Ultimately, they enter judgment, and then they set those judgments aside, even though that's foreign to what we do in ordinary civil proceedings, because the person's brought back. And I addressed that in my brief with the idea of equity. But the point remains, the problem here, the reason those bonds could not be satisfied is because the director preemptorily denied the renewal. I said revoked, I meant denied the renewal, and kept Mr. Robeson from addressing the issues of which she complains. I thank the court for its time today, and we look forward to your decision.
Thank you.